going to be focusing in the time that I have on a couple of very specific areas, both of which relate to kids in schools. I think one of the messages that I have already heard in the two previous presentations, and that I'll be speaking to very directly, is that there are policies and forces very distal to much of our work that have very direct, and I would suggest often far more direct, impact on the health and well-being of young people than the direct interventions that we so often pay attention to. Living in a violent environment is but one example. I'll be focusing on schools. And for this presentation, I'm going to be focusing on the role of schools in improving health outcomes of young people, and particularly as it relates to No Child Left Behind, or as people in education say, NCLB. And the second is the role of school-based physical education in reducing overweight and obesity. And that isn't federal policy level, that is state policy level, and we'll be talking about that. But first, let me just talk for a moment or two of what are some of the essential components of NCLB. For those who don't dwell in the world of education, one is that it has been implemented explicitly to increase accountability for student performance. Under this legislation, states must establish sanctions as well as rewards for school-level student performance, which is to say that schools that do not have students advancing according to what has become known as AYP, and I'll talk about it in a moment, will be sanctioned, and those that do achieve this will be rewarded. Annual reading in math, which is the focus of standardized examinations, will be implemented for all third to eighth graders and for high school students at least once. There will be a standardized examination. The claims that have been put forward in favor of this legislation are, one, that it will improve test scores. Two, is that having national standards are far better than local standards. And given the variability of local standards, much can be said for that argument. Third is that it will increase accountability and oversight of the public school system. There's increased attention to minorities, increase in education quality nationally, and this legislation will improve the public's attitude toward public education. Other components of NCLB is that academic advancement will be predicated on successfully passing national examinations. There's not an opt-out, for example, for special education students. There's not an opt-out for those who do not speak English or English proficiency, which is to say the examination is given in one language, English. Schools that fail to meet AYP or adequate yearly performance, which has become the focus and some would say the obsession of all school leaders, will first get assistance from a state pot of money, but after 3 years, students can transfer out. Let me just tell you a little bit about the students in Baltimore. 2 years ago, 6,300 kids entered the ninth grade in Baltimore. Today, 1,900 of them have dropped out. Of those who still are in school, 1,600 have not passed one. of these examinations. Not one. Schools have many functions beyond the acquisition of reading and math skills. And I'd like to focus, because the power of it, I would suggest, is profound, on school climate. For school climate and school environment not only impacts the educational outcomes, but the health outcomes of young people. Dot Brown, in her introduction, said that I have worked on the Ad Health study, which I've had the tremendous pleasure and honor to do. Let me tell you very briefly about it, because the data that I'm going to be sharing is derived from that study. It was originally established as part of the NIH reauthorization in 1992. And for those who are interested in the politics of research in the United States, it actually was originally established in 1988. And the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill submitted a proposal, the Pop Center there submitted a proposal for it, and it was scored pretty well, which was a 104. For those who don't pursue federal grants, perfect score is 1 or 100, and the end of the barrel is 500. A 104 is probably in the 99.9 top centile. It is better than okay. It was funded, it was awarded, it was released, and they started hiring staff in 1988, and the senior senator from North Carolina heard that there was a study, which happened to have been called the Teen Sex Study, not its official name, it was American Study of Adolescent something something, but it became known as the Teen Sex Study, and right in his backyard there was a Teen Sex Study. So Senator Helms called up Lou Sullivan, who was then head of Health and Human Services, and he said, this cannot happen in my state. Lou agreed with that and summarily canceled a peer-reviewed, federally funded and approved study. So it was actually 4 years later that under NIH reauthorization, the new study was established. Again, it was recompeted. And again, North Carolina was the recipient of the award, and Dick Udry was the principal investigator, and it was that study that I had the opportunity to be a part of. So maybe before just sharing you with some of the data, just a word about how the study was done. Initially, we took 80 high schools in America. A high school was defined as having an 11th grade. It had to have at least 30 students in the school. And in fact, our schools ranged from having 42 to 5,450 students in it. We then took the main feeder school, middle school or junior high school, that went into the high school. But not every high school in America has a middle school. Some are K through 12, 6 through 12, 7 through 12. So we wound up with 134 schools. Went into the schools and surveyed all the kids in those schools on a given day, and wound up with a sample of about 90,000. From that sample, we drew down a core sample and then some special samples, and went into the homes of approximately 20,000 young people in the 7th through 12th grade. In the initial work that we did, we found that school was associated positively or negatively with every health outcome that we looked at. Specifically, when we looked at school connectedness, and we had a five-dimension variable of school connectedness, we found that for alcohol, cigarettes, and marijuana use, as young people felt increasingly engaged with schools, the use of all of those substances declined. This is cross-sectional data, simply associations. For emotional distress, that's predominantly depression, and suicidality, that suicidal thoughts and attempts. What we saw is that as young people reported that they felt more engaged in school, more connected to school, depression declined and suicidality declined. This is independent of suicide prevention programs in the school. This is independent of or controlling for whether there are drug prevention programs in the school. These data are independent of whether there were bullying prevention programs in the school. That is, young people felt connected to school. Violence and deviant behavior are things like shoplifting, breaking windows, and vandalism, declined. In pregnancy, declined. A good school is good contraception. I would say a good school is the best contraception. So we then wanted to go and find out, what is it about school that made a difference? And this is a longitudinal study, so it was done originally in 94-95, then in 96-97, and the next data are looking at 2 points in time. It looks at transitions into various behaviors, into cigarette use. And what we see is that what we look at is transitions into those behaviors as a function of how connected a young person feels to a teacher. And what we see is that sense of being connected to a teacher, when it exists, is associated with less involvement of every negative behavior, less cigarette use. And let me just give you a sense. If you look at, just look at the non to regular on the right side of the graph, and for each of the next few slides, because that's going to be, I think, most telling. To go from one standard deviation, or to go from the mean to a higher level of, to just go to the right there where it says 5.3, that shift represents an increase of 15% risk in cigarette smoking. So to going to one level of higher sense of connectedness with teachers decreases cigarette smoking by 15%. Kids were half as likely to transition from never smoking to being regular smokers when they felt connected to a teacher. They were half as likely, again, look at the right side, none to regular, half as likely to transition to regularly getting drunk when they felt connected to a teacher. They were 50% less likely to transition to regular marijuana use when they felt connected to a teacher. And they were half as likely to report attempting suicide when they felt connected to a teacher. School engagement, I would suggest, is highly protective for young people. Initiating violence, the same. So how does NCLB impact school climate and engagement? Well, there is a disincentive built in to this legislation for poorer performing students because they screw up our school data. And so do kids with emotional problems, because we have to focus on improving test scores in reading and math. And kids with behavior problems, because not only do we have to focus academically, but we also have to report all behavioral conflicts that occur in the school. And this will put us on the blacklist. Better that those kids are in your school than they are in mine. And students for whom English is a second language also get in the way. Special education does too. Essentially, those who are most likely to benefit from the non-academic components of school are most disadvantaged by this legislation. There's a focus on standardized testing, which reduces customization of a curriculum. Let me just give you one wonderful example of customization. An English teacher I know in Baltimore who teaches the eighth grade last year, early in the school year, was in the girls' washroom, and she overheard two girls in the stall crying and crying and crying. And she knocked on the stall, and finally the girls came out, and she said, "Can you tell me what's going on?" And they at first wouldn't talk, and then one of them said, "Jeanette's boyfriend was murdered last night." She said, "It dawned on me right then that what I was teaching in my English class was so out of touch with the reality of those kids' lives that I was mouthing words that they couldn't hear." And she said, "I went home that evening and decided that I would restructure my curriculum. I would restructure how I taught English this year and base it on the stories and lives of these kids." And she did. And she had readings that tapped the lives of these kids. She got them to write poetry and write songs and write short stories, and they put together at the end of the year a volume. Customizing curriculum so it engages kids, so it reaches them, is not standardized approaches. It diminishes investment in enrichment programs such as the visual arts, music, and physical education, which I'll focus on in a minute. It diminishes attention paid to the non-academic components of education. And it diminishes the attention paid to the interpersonal skills that make school so protective in the lives of young people. Let me turn to another issue, somewhat different, but somewhat related. And that is physical education. And what's the role of physical education in schools? Well, let me just take you on a very quick visual tour, sharing with you what I will assume everyone in this room already knows. 1985, 1987, 1989, 1991, the first states with obesity prevalence at 15 to 19%, 1993, 1995, 1997, the first states weigh in with obesity prevalence over 20%, 1999, 2001, the first states weigh in with obesity prevalence over 25%. What we see in the United States is that since 1980, overweight, which for this discussion is BMI over 25, has doubled for children and tripled for adolescents in the United States. Last year, the annual obesity attributable U.S. medical expenditures was $117 billion. Recently, there's been a flurry of state-level policy to try to deal with this epidemic. So what are school districts doing that impact physical education? Well, 62% report that they used fitness tests last year. The same number said that they evaluate student fitness. 51% say they encourage family involvement in physical activity. 54% increase the amount of time students spend in physical activity. This all sounds wonderful. 57% required recess for elementary schools. All increases since 2000. But what it also doesn't tell you is that 44% last year of high school students had zero physical activity or physical education in the school, and only 6% of junior and senior high school students had 5 days of physical activity. So let me share with you some of the very recent research my colleague David Menchik and I have done. This actually will be released this month in November's Archives of Diseases, Pediatrics, and Adolescents. What we see here is a couple of things. Our sample involved 3,345 8th through 12th graders at time zero, okay, which is actually wave two of Ad Health. Time zero, and then they were followed up 5 years later. So they had moved then into young adulthood, okay? And the central question that we asked is, frequency of physical activity predict overweight status at time one? What we see here are just a few things that I'd like to point out. One is, if you look at the bottom row for BMI greater than 25 at time zero, there were 941 kids. As adults, one-ninth of them were not overweight. Eight-ninths remained overweight. This is consistent with what we know. 85% of obese adolescents become obese adults. Secondly, what we see here is that when you look at the time one column on the far right, we see that over 50% of our sample, of our random high school sample, became overweight by the time they were young adults. This is an increase from 28% to 50%+ in a 5-year period of time. So what do we see about the role of school-based physical education in the odds of being overweight as adults? Well, the columns over the top are the odds ratios of being overweight at time one. That's as an adult now, becoming overweight or remaining overweight. Let me just point out a few things here. One is, if you look at the far right column, remaining overweight, it is to say if you are overweight as a high school student, the evidence is not good that it will help physical education will help reduce weight. It is not a good weight reduction strategy overall, or it is simply insufficient. Secondly, what we see, when you look at the last row, each additional day is adding 1 day of physical education. So one more day than one. For every day added of physical education, it reduces adult overweight status by 5%. For those young people, when their weight was normal at time one, and normal isn't so normal, it's just under a BMI of 25. So for that population of young people, 5% reduction in overweight status as an adult for every day of physical education added. And for those who had 5 days of physical education, remember, that's 6% last year of all junior and senior high schools. For those who had 5% as adults, they had a 28% greater chance of being normal weight as adults than those who didn't. A substantial difference. What do we conclude? There certainly appears to be a positive relationship between the number of days of physical education in school and overweight as adult. Physical education has a more positive effect on maintaining normal weight than on reducing overweight. Less than 2/3 of America's youth engage in vigorous physical exercise 3 or more times per week for more than 20 minutes. Physical activity outside of school goes down from elementary school. So those who say, well, kids are playing outside, they're compensating for it. The evidence is strong that that isn't true. Physical activity patterns are established in adolescence, carry over to adulthood. It is a critical age to learn these behaviors. And PE in school appears to be an important tool in addressing the obesity epidemic. School PE policy matters. Thank you.
I want to thank all the presenters for what I think were just wonderful presentations. We have a few minutes for questions, and I will entertain questions if you can stand up and come to the front, or if you can stay at your seat and speak loudly enough. So first question, young lady there. Do you want to stand up so that, I'm sorry, we don't have any microphones. She was wondering if you looked at sports at all in your study.
We did, in fact, look at sports, and we looked at 3 different types of sports. The American Academy of Pediatrics has a clustering of sports. Simply stated, what we found was that many of the high compact competitive sports, and even the low compact highly competitive sports, so football, basketball, baseball being examples, were not associated with maintenance of normal weight. It was in fact what some would define as lower intensity and others define as life sports that seem to have the strongest association.
The question is, how do you create a positive climate within school systems? And I'll start, and Bob, I'm sure, can add several more volumes. One is, I really think it has to do with social will. I think critical incidents, sentinel events, you know, both, all of us can say many, many data elements, you know, look at how bad our weight is, et cetera. But it isn't until you have 1 or 2 critical cases where you have the human face behind the critical case, behind the critical data, that creates the momentum for saying we have a problem here and we have something that needs our attention, our social attention. And unfortunately, in our society, we tend to look for those problems rather than the happy news. A second step, I think, really has to do with using that critical incident to be starting to look at our own lives and our own school climate to sort of say, what are the things that we could do that are, I call the 3 bear model, meaning that it's low cost, doable, something that you can integrate into your system relatively quickly, versus a higher volume or higher cost intervention. And I, as I talk to people across the country, note that people are very hungry for information on what can I do. And in all of these areas, fortunately, there are folks, researchers, who have spent a lot of energy looking at best practices, evidence of what works. But I also caution you about the fact that this is not a cookie-cutter approach, because people will say, oh, that intervention on nutrition or that intervention on blank, name the intervention of school climate, was done in that school 100 miles, 500 miles, 1,000 miles from us. That school is different. Nobody understands our community. Nobody understands our school. But I can honestly tell you that there are universal truths about school climate and how to create those opportunities for connectivity that Bob was talking about so eloquently. So partly it's looking at the models where connectivity has happened and start to say, how do I adapt it to my environment? I often think of McDonald's, and I don't have any stock in McDonald's, especially with this crisis. But, you know, you can go to McDonald's anywhere in the world, and you'll get a quarter pounder. It's the same quarter pounder, same standards. But if you go to Paris, there's wine on the menu. If you go to Hawaii, there's two-finger poi on the menu. So McDonald's has learned how to keep integrated the critical elements. If you go to Moscow, by the way, also there's the quarter pounder. If you have the critical elements of what's worked in the interventions that you could review, that you could be the champion for, but think about what are the local adaptations that are required to take into account local values, local concerns, local issues. And the last point I want to make is the role of champions. We don't make progress unless someone has that fear in their belly or that compelling passion to make significant change and is able to show that it can work.
I'm sure glad you took that because you did a fabulous response. I would just make two comments, one about the quarter pounder and the other about best practices. Some of you may or may not be aware that the quarter pounder is so omnipresent that the World Bank actually has an economic standard of the quarter pounder, where since it exists in 181 countries of the world, they use the price of a quarter pounder for economic comparisons. We can discuss later where the lowest and most expensive countries that sell quarter pounders are. The other thing that I would mention is for those who are interested in best practices around school engagement and school connectedness, if you go to the first website over there, but instead of the /PFRH, go to /MCI. We have spent 3 years looking at interventions, and there is a lot of empirical evidence. So if I understand it, really the question is directionality or causality, and how do we know which came first, the chicken and the egg? The way we're able to know is because we're able to look at transitions into behavior and out of behavior, because we have longitudinal data, we're able to look at transitions into and out of behavior, and we're able to look at transitions from no identified adult at time one in school, no identified adult in school at time one, and then identified adult at time two. So we're able to look at both transitions into and out of behavior. And what I didn't speak to here is that there's also, for many of these same behaviors, for kids who did not have a relationship with a teacher. And while we don't have good data about other adults in schools, I would suggest that there probably is applicability for other adults as well, because we can extrapolate from other research like Emmy Werner's, that it not only has a protective or a preventive effect in reducing transition into the behavior, but it has an effect of increasing reduction from use. And we certainly see that with cigarette smoking. So that's how we know, because we're able to look at it both ways.
Repeat the last part of the question.
We don't have really as good a longitudinal data there. There have been some wonderful work. The National Academies of Science did a study group about 2 years ago on school engagement. Deborah Sipek from Stanford headed that group up. And what they report out is that approximately 40% of high school seniors, by the time they are seniors and still in school, are disengaged from school. Now, whether that is higher or lower, I don't know. What we do see is that there are more kids graduating high school today than certainly a generation ago. So school retention has gone up. I'm not sure that's a proxy measure, however, of school engagement. There are a lot of factors that play into school retention, and economics not being the least of those factors. So the question is, what are the factors associated with school engagement? Are they more likely to be small schools or rural schools, etc.? So we looked at this explicitly. A, it's not small schools. B, it's not rural schools. C, it's not parochial schools. D, it's not urban schools, nor is it suburban schools. E, it's not having teachers who have more master's degrees or higher levels of, and F, is that F? It is not teachers with more years of experience. Those are the things that it is not. What it is, now, it is, I said it's not smaller schools. In truth, what we see is there is a school size factor. It isn't smaller classrooms for school engagement, but it is smaller schools. When you cross schools of about 1,200, you begin to see a logarithmic decline in school engagement. So school size does matter. Far more importantly, what we see is a principal who understands, and a school board and a superintendent who values and understands that school environment does improve educational attainment. And the reason why I link that with NCLB is because that legislation has put such a focus on average yearly progress, or AYP, that very few principals have really come to understand this. There are a few school districts in the United States where there are dramatic exceptions. One is in Anchorage, Alaska, if anyone is here, probably one of the most progressive school districts in the country, where school climate and school engagement is part of the report card, and a whole set of factors that relate to that are part of the school report card. Chicago is working on this, New Haven is, but you can still count on one hand those that are really working at a district level working on these issues.
The question was about homeschooling and what was the impact of that. And was asking the researchers if they had any knowledge or research on that area. Am I correct? And the answer was no. Any other?
Share my bias. Uh-huh.
Okay, back there.
Was has anyone thought about using the new knowledge of adolescent brain development to sort of do a social marketing campaign, if I understand your question? That has happened to some degree, and I think what's happened more is that these books have been selling like hotcakes, and that although it's easy to be flippant about them, I think parents of adolescents are really hungry for explanations for why their relationships with their adolescents change, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse, when their kids get to be adolescents. So I do think that helping parents understand normal developmental processes the same way that they understand normal developmental processes for toddlers, for example, you understand that if your toddler has a meltdown in the supermarket, that's a developmental stage and that too will pass. And I think understanding some of the kinds of ups and downs of adolescence, and that you as a parent are not responsible personally for ruining your child's life and that this too shall pass is important. So that has happened. But one of the things that I think would be really helpful is harnessing the information that we have about adolescent brain development to build political will among policymakers, and really to help policymakers understand that these are not people who are hell-bent on being rebellious and obnoxious and rude or who have blatant disregard for their own safety. That this, again, part of this is an integrated set of biobehavioral developmental processes, and that we need to protect them as a vulnerable population, albeit very different than toddlers, for example.
Okay, we have questions. We have time for about two more questions. Why don't I try?
The question is, what is engagement? Yeah. It is. I like going to school. I work hard when I am at school. I complete most of my homework when it is assigned to me. I participate in school activities, and I am involved in after-school activities to the extent possible. So it isn't measured on behaviors per se, but it is how I feel vis-a-vis school. We've also looked at relationship between teachers and young people in the school. So questions such as, do teachers have a high expectation of me, which is a critical element? Do I try my best? Do teachers provide me support when I need support? Can I get questions answered when I have questions? are the types of things when we look at student-teacher relationships. So what we are not talking about per se are social emotional supports, much more education / emotional supports, if you will.
Let's try one more question and then we'll have to end the session. Oh, wait over there.
The question is there anything that we can do preventively if we look upstream to the point of what do you do for elementary school kids or even pre-elementary school? And I know from looking at the program at APHA this year, there are amazing numbers of sessions on primary prevention as well as early intervention. What I fail to see in a lot of the work in the field right now is a lack of two things. One is intergenerational impact. And the fact is that you can do a great job, again, in educating the little child about exercising or having PE at work, their work equivalent. But I don't see efforts about engaging, so when the child goes home, what are the offerings in the house? How much is physical activity part of the culture of the family? Do they have fun together? And there have been campaigns, like the VERB campaign from CDC in the past, but again, I don't see much of that intergenerational impact. And finally, I don't see enough, and we're, you know, right at the verge of this, stream right now of effort to be thinking fully about environment. So for example, we're evaluating some coalitions in California funded by the California Endowment that have to do with asthma prevention. And we were doing some focus groups, and we were talking to some of the parents in LA, and they were sharing that they didn't feel comfortable letting their kids outside of the house exercise or play on good days when the air quality in LA is acceptable on that rare day. And it turned out that it was pit bull dogs that were in these communities. And so the parents were worried about dog bites. So again, when I push and include you and think about this iceberg, to be thinking about the social context in which these kids are raised and where does exercise fit in to the climate of violence prevention and other factors.
Unfortunately, it's 12 o'clock and we have to end, and I want to thank you for attending. Thank you.